Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Reimagine's executive editor, Matt Ladner, talks to Mike McShane, director of national research at EdChoice, about his new report, The Accountability Myth. The report examines the often levied argument that public schools are academically, financially, and democratically accountable. McShane argues that the dysfunctional and outdated public education system leads to a lack of accountability of all three of those tentpoles. What reforms can be made to change things? That question more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to the Reimagine podcast. We're very happy today to have as our guest Mike McShane of EdChoice. Mike has a new study out called The Accountability Myth. I read it. I loved it. And Mike, you make three broad arguments in this piece. Tell us what your arguments are.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. The big one is kind of contained in the title. We talk a lot about schools being accountable. Whenever if you sit in a hearing or you're in some discussion about school choice, you'll often hear people who oppose school choice saying, oh, well, see, the reason we can't allow private schools to get funding or any of that sort of stuff, or charter schools or any of those, is because they're not accountable. And you have to understand, see, public schools are accountable, and private schools aren't. People in the private school choice movement, and I think I want to be very clear, I think that they are right when they say this, but they frequently say, hey, look, you know, private schools actually are accountable. They're often more accountable than public schools are because parents can vote with their feet. We can talk about all of that. But I wanted to write a paper that actually contended with the other part of that statement. So not about whether or not private schools are accountable, but whether or not public schools are accountable. And so as you said, I sort of make three arguments and think of three ways in which we think about schools being accountable: financially accountable, democratically accountable, and academically accountable. And I argue that traditional public schools are really not in any meaningful way held accountable by any of those methods. They're not democratically held accountable. They're not accountable for their academic results, and they're not accountable for how they spend money.
Well, let's take these one by one. Let's start with the academically accountable, right? Basically what we're describing here is there is a subset or a structure of compliance, sort of state compliance regulations, right? That, we've constructed, and we say, you know, we're going to look at your test results. And if we don't like the results, like, something bad will happen. But this does kind of tend to end up being like double secret probation in Animal House at some point, right? Like, how often do district schools actually receive some meaningful sanction because of results?
Right. For sure. I mean, like, that's the thing. And one of the things that sparked this paper was, like, years ago, I was working on some stuff because when I lived in my hometown of Kansas City, Missouri, you know, every year the state of Missouri would put out the results of its accountability system. And it sort of had what, fully accredited schools. And then there was one that was like a kind of mid-range and then unaccredited school districts. And of the 518 districts, routinely like two would not be accredited, and like two would be approaching accreditation, and the other 514 would be fully accredited. And if you just kind of peel away the onion a little bit and you actually looked at some of the numbers that undergirded these things, you would see these hilarious distributions where it's like, you know, your student attendance or your AP completion or whatever it was. And you would just pull the numbers out and graph them. And you would see these hilarious curves where it's like, you know, 70% was what you needed to be to get accredited. You'd see these big clusters like right at seven. You know, there wasn't like a normal distribution of scores across these things. And what you also saw was states like picking and choosing all of these different things where it's like, you know, you can choose AP scores or like ACT work keys or whatever, all of these different things that you just obviously saw schools saying, oh, well, like, I'm going to pick the pieces of the menu that make my school look the best. And so the upshot of this is that even before, so this was like, even sort of designed as they want to, you know, schools were very rarely held accountable. Like they didn't actually meet sanctions. And, you know, even if you scored, you happened to be in those two districts that like didn't score the way you want to, like what actually happened to you? You had to fill out a lot more paperwork. You had some tense meetings or whatever, but like very rarely, occasionally the state would take over your board and sort of install their own board. You know, from like a kid's perspective, it's not clear how that, you know, how anything like there actually mattered, any big changes that took place. And then you had the Common Core, where states, you know, again, a state like Missouri, I think when they had the Missouri standards, the Missouri test, then they adopted the Common Core, but I think still had the Missouri test. And then they had the Common Core test, and then they got rid of the Common Core standards, but still had the Common. So they had like four tests and four standards in 5 years as they, you know, adopted and unadopted and whatever. So most accountability was paused for that. And now we've had the coronavirus pandemic where other states are pausing as a result of that. So it's like, even under its best description, it wasn't really doing its job. And now we've just straight up paused everything. So even if it was working differently, it wouldn't be doing what it's supposed to.
Yeah, it's struck me, Mike, over the last year that, you know, some of the old timers like me started off in this movement reading things like Chubb and Moe's Politics, Markets, and American Schools. And we were kind of, you know, had it, you know, drilled into our heads that there were some very basic political science 101 type of reasons that stuff like this happened, right? Like, how can a state like create an accountability system and yet, like, you know, a large portion of the kids don't learn how to read and there's nothing that remotely approaches like meaningful accountability, right? And, you know, from that, you know, sort of political science 101 perspective, you kind of look at this and go, yeah, this is what you'd expect to happen, right? This didn't happen by accident, right? This isn't like, oh no, we blew a fuse and we forgot to hold the schools accountable. Like, but maybe it'd be helpful for you to tell us why do you think that happens, right?
Yeah.
Why is it we have 50 state accountability systems and pretty weak tea as far as right. accountability goes? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's classic. If you go back and you read your, as you mentioned, your Chubb and Moe or your James Q. Wilson or your, you know, your classic like principal agent problems here, right? Where you have the state board of education, state legislature that wants something done. And so you have schools that are supposed to do that, but they're diffuse. They're somewhat decentralized. They have a lot of freedom, whether that's at the classroom level or whether that's at the school level. And they just have a lot of latitude to kind of act the way that they actually want to. And so especially if the people in the school don't buy into the metrics that you have, they don't think the tests are any good, they don't think you're doing anything, they don't really have like a strong motivation to make sure your accountability system works great. So it's like a system that was like imposed on them that they didn't want in the first place. And we're shocked when they like don't break their backs trying to make it work, right? So you have that whole kind of top-down, bottom-up problem. But then you just also have all of the issues around sort of measurement and data and how data is used. And, you know, the I'm blanking on what's that law that I have to turn my card in that it's like once you start observing something, it immediately yes. becomes manipulated.
I'm blanking on it too.
I was gonna say there's someone, everyone who's listening to this podcast who like went to graduate school is like shouting,
right.
Shouting at us. We'll look it up.
You can't measure something without changing it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's like the same thing that happens in a lot of these cases. So all of the things that were related to doing it, and look, and I get states have tried to alter these things. They've tried to make them like less gameable. So you have to think of the earlier generations of like even preceding No Child Left Behind or right after No Child Left Behind comes out, where it's like, well, okay, it's going to be all about kind of test scores and it's going to be just proficiency rates. And so people started to understand, okay, maybe, you know, growth is important in that and we need to put other metrics in there. But I don't think that they ever really figured out the kind of basket of metrics to use that actually works. And that leads me to think, I mean, we spent 20 years, billions of dollars trying to figure out the exact way to like build the mousetrap. And it just didn't work that great. So I don't doubt that maybe some people read this report and say their takeaway from it is like, and this is why we need to build even better accountability, you know, accountability 4.0 or 5.0 or whatever generation that we're on now. And I think for me, I'm just like, look, God bless you. Give it a try. Maybe that system exists out there that's able to do this without the kind of pernicious downsides or others. I'm just kind of skeptical that that exists because a lot of smart people with a lot of money have been trying to do it for a long time and haven't quite figured it out yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, well, I think it'll get to our point on the last one, but let's talk a little bit about financial accountability. I was struck in your paper, the description of Senator Robert Kennedy, the floor speech in the United States Senate. It must have been back in the 60s, right?
Yeah, for sure.
They were debating what may have been like the second federal program to give federal funding to public schools. And he basically said, how do we know this is going to be, you know, helpful? Like, you know, so I could almost hear his Boston accent, right, in the quote that you give in the study. But yeah, tell us a little bit about financial accounting.
We at EdChoice poll working with Morning Consult, a polling firm. We poll a nationally representative sample of Americans every month. We poll a nationally representative sample of teachers every quarter. We've been doing that since the beginning of 2020. But even before that, we've done our Schooling in America survey since 2013. So we've had a national poll of folks for years now. And a common question that we ask is to ask people like, how much, well, first we sort of ask people, do you think schools should spend more or less? And generally speaking, majorities of people say, we think that K-12 public schools should spend more money. But then we give people the information of what their state spends and people are shocked by it. They don't realize that that's how much it is and the numbers come down. We've also started to add questions, just asking people, how much do you think your state spends on education or your child's school gets on education? And they, on average, estimate that number to be about a third of what it actually is, somewhere between like a third and half of what it actually is. And if you just put them all in a number line, something like 80% of people guess wrong too low. And some are a little bit closer to what it actually is, but something like 80% of people think that we're spending less money than we actually are. And it's because it's really hard. It's hard to find out how much schools actually spend. Even at the state level, I mean, you have to kind of know where you're looking. It doesn't immediately show up if you're searching for these things. And even though in the Every Student Succeeds Act, which was passed, back in 2015, there are all sorts of provisions that were put in there around financial transparency and that we're supposed to have more spending at the school level because it used to be sort of just at the district level. Even then, it's really hard to find. It's hard to find on state websites. It's hard to find on district websites. So people just don't know how much schools spend. So if they don't know how much schools spend, they can't hold schools accountable for spending it. They don't know what it is in the first place, you know?
Well, there's also just, I have a lot of sympathy for state lawmakers because, you know, if you take a poll, do you want to spend more on education? People say yes. Do you want to spend more on highways? Yes. Do you want to spend more on hospitals and have medical care? Yes. Do you want to have higher taxes? No. Right. So like the lawmakers actually have to balance all these contending demands.
For sure. Right.
At least by, you know, global standards, American schools are pretty well funded, but, you know, not so great performing. Well, let's get to your last argument, which I think is the one that actually underpins everything, right? Is it that school districts are democratically accountable, right? We've seen opponents will wrap themselves in the flag of democracy, like Pericles in Athens or something, right? And say, we are democratically accountable. You charter schools, your private choice, you're like, you know, some sort of monarchist or fascist or something. You don't believe in democracy. We do. Tell us about that.
Well, and it's funny too, because this is obviously happening across the backdrop of seeing all these contentious school board meetings and things like that, which I think some people think would undermine the point that I'm making in this, but I actually think it serves to validate it because people are like, whoa, school board meetings, people attending them, people talking at them, they're so out of the norm. It's like, yeah. So the argument that I'm making is that traditional public schools, the almost 14,000 school districts that we have in America, are overseen by school boards. School boards are elected from the public to oversee those schools. By and large, they are elected in what we call off-cycle elections. So these are elections everybody knows, other than, you know, now what in Virginia and New Jersey, they're having a weird election kind of off-cycle. But it's at least at the beginning of November. People kind of know, oh yeah, beginning of November every year is election year. Every 2 years, we're going to get our representatives. Every 4 years, it's president. We got governors, all these people on these normal election days. Well, you ask people, well, when does your school board get elected? And it's like some random day in June or April or something. And you can look and you can see just the turnout levels are so much lower because everybody comes out for election day. And in these one-off elections, that turnout's way down. And there's been a lot of political science research on this that shows that when you have depressed turnout in elections like that, organized interest groups can have an outsized effect. So if you're, I don't know, like a teachers union, and suddenly you only have to win an election that has like 1,000 people participating in it or 5,000 people, as opposed to 25,000 or 50,000 people participating in it, it's a lot easier to kind of throw your weight around and get what you want. And so we have these off-cycle elections. People are elected from a very small segment of the population. I use some examples in there, again, of my hometown of Kansas City, where routinely folks, the only person who gets the necessary signatures gets elected. Like they're not even contested because only one person gets the like 300 signatures or some laughably low number to get. I think there's only been one or two really competitive elections, and only one of them had like what I would consider to have a sort of substantial turnout in it. So we're just seeing these small fractions of the population elect folks. It's generally like, it's not like people are really participating in these meetings or anything, except when you see these things, these flashpoints. So like right now something's happening, but you know, you'll see it in some places where it's like, you know, some teacher does something controversial. And so everybody gets fired up about that. But in 2 months, they're going to go back to being quiet and sleepy again. So right. I just don't think that they are these kind of paragons of small D democracy. And the fact that it's become almost impossible to move those elections on cycle when basically everyone agrees to the negative effects of them. Like there's no one really seriously debating the other side that's like, oh, it's good to drive down the turnout in these elections. Like that's better for kids and for people. So they just don't do it because they don't have to.
You'll hear people make coded arguments for that, right? Sure. You'll say things like, well, it's important that the voters have a grasp of the issues facing this right? We wouldn't want the hoi polloi getting involved in democracy, right? Only the elect, right? You know, the people that know what's going on. Like, they're the ones that should govern the district, right? I mean, that's a gross exaggeration of what they say.
No, but there's like, so it is important. It is important to linger for a second. Like, there was a reason why we instituted these things called school boards and why we held elections off cycle. And it was generally because of kind of machine politics. So education used to be because there's so many opportunities for jobs in the central office and whatever. It was a really great place for patronage posts, right? And this is why so much of this stuff comes from these era, step and lane pay scales, all that sort of stuff kind of comes from the progressive era reforms of what were probably deeply corrupt and ineffective schools. Now, you know, so 100 years ago, we said, look, we're going to move these things off cycle so that the political machines can't do the same stuff that they did in their normal elections. We're going to try and have these more disinterested people on the side. And look, we can debate about the degree to which that's true or the degree to which that would actually solve it. But at least I get that. I get the argument. I understand why they wanted to do it. And while I would still maintain that many of our nation's major cities are not particularly well-governed institutions, I don't think they're run by corrupt, you know, boss, like in Kansas City, Boss Pendergast, who is calling all the shots. I don't think that that's true. I think it's okay to move those elections back on cycle. So it's sort of a solution to a problem that doesn't exist anymore, and can probably go the way of a lot of the other sort of civil service reforms of that time period that don't really apply anymore.
No, it's a very good point. I mean, like in the old days, the Postmaster General was, you know, appointed by the President of the United States in like absolutely job number one was to dispatch Spence patronage jobs around the country, right?
Like, right.
That was the era that they were trying to deal with. But the situation we're dealing with now, it appears to me anyway, is that, you know, the employee interests in district schools unionized back in the 1960s, and in combination with major contractors, they find, you know, what economists describe as the regulatory capture of districts to be not terribly challenging. You're right. So in a way, it circles back to the conversation we're having about academic accountability, right?
Yeah.
Like, things are this way for a reason, right? It's not accidental. It may be accidental in the sense that some things were done in the past to respond to what they thought were problems in the past, but they stay this way for a reason, right? There are people that actually want them to stay this way, right? If you try to move the school board elections to general uniform date, you're going to get opposition.
Have fun.
It won't be very public, right? But they will be down there at the state legislature saying, we don't want this, right? So when you add all, when you're at your three arguments together, this would seem to be consistent with what we actually see out there in terms of results, is a system that's leaves a lot to be desired, right?
Yeah.
I mean, now some people, I mean, there are people, there are right of center people that still have sort of a warm spot in their heart for, you know, sort of the small town, New Hampshire town meeting, you know, vision of school district democracy. And I don't think it's not an either or, is it? It's not like every school district democracy is profoundly, deeply flawed and they're irredeemable, but, you know, or that the flag of democracy deserves, you know, the districts could deserve to wrap themselves in it, right? I mean, it's probably a spectrum when you say that.
And look, like I said, there's almost 14,000 school districts in America. So, like, there are a lot of incredibly well-run school. You know, if you have 14,000 of anything, you can graph one bell curve. And there's some very, very well-run school districts that have lots of Democratic participation, all of those things. Like, we should not deny that those things exist. But I think you also, I mean, there's just this sort of broader idea. And so this is me sort of thinking, sort of speaking to my friends on the right side of the spectrum that have this sort of view. They like the small d democracy. They like those. One of the things that I try to point out is that you got to remember that these school boards, A, as we mentioned, are kind of left over from the progressive era that was a sort of kind of bigger government solution to these issues. It was a belief in having these kind of disinterested professionals manage things, which I think there's a pretty strong conservative critique of that kind of more technocratic style of management. But you also have to understand that there are lots of other local governing bodies that have elections and that are responsible to people. And so creating like multiple overlapping layers of government and democracy and all of those things, like, isn't necessarily the best solution, right? So, I mean, I just think of like school districts, for example, as I said, Missouri has like 518 of them. They have all weird jagged edges. Like, I think Kansas City, there's something like 11 or 14 of them have some area of it because the boundaries are shifting a lot. Then you take a place like Florida, who said, hey, look, we're just going to make our school districts contiguous with our counties, right? Like, right. That seems to make a lot of sense. Like, rather than saying we're going to have a bunch of these tiny school districts that have like their own weird taxing authorities, and it's like not entirely clear like why and where and what happens and all of those things, like saying, no, we're going to try and make some municipal boundaries contiguous with one another. We're going to try and make school district boundaries contiguous with city boundaries or county boundaries or any of those things. Like, those are all things that I don't think conservatives should immediately recoil from, because it's trying to make government simpler. It's trying to make government clearer to people. It's ultimately trying to make it more responsible, because people have a better understanding of like, oh, well, I live in Kansas City, but I'm actually in this different school district, but I'm in this county. And so I have like these three different layers of government on top of me. They're all getting their cut of my property tax dollars. I'm not sure who I'm supposed to complain to about what. So simplifying, streamlining those things, I think, are actually good for civic participation. They're good for understanding. They're good for kind of fiscal responsibility, and they're good for that kind of democracy because you have more of a stake where you understand, oh, this is the person I go to when I have a problem. This is where the issues are coming from. This is where my money is going.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have a bit of a generational, you know, challenge in sort of like culturally transmitting lessons learned across, you know, within the school reform movement itself, right? I see things like people are like, yeah, we're going to go take over school boards. And I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, well, people have tried that before, right?
Right.
You know, I was born and raised in Texas. I watched the business community in Texas, they were in Houston, struggle to like, you know, I mean, they put a lot of time, money, and effort into school board elections in HISD. And right now, every single board member was elected by the teacher union, right? There are things like there have been efforts for a couple of districts in Colorado where they tried to take over the board. There's been other efforts where reform boards get in and they discover that the district has signed long-term contracts and they can't really change anything. And then, wow, next cycle, guess what? They get turfed out, right? Or other instances where, you know, a so-called reform board gets elected and they don't agree about anything and they squabble amongst themselves and then they get turfed out, right? So I did enjoy reading Max Eden's recent AEI study where he basically suggested moving all, you know, school district races to the uniform day, right? I mean, that strikes me as a sensible reform that is something that state lawmakers could do. And, you know, would it cure the world's pain and solve every problem and dry every tear? No. But would it make districts more responsive to their constituencies? Yeah, I kind of think it probably would. But what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, that to me is like the easy step one of this, which is like school district elections should be at the same time that other elections are. As I said, I think there are very few people in the sort of world of political science or anything that disagree that these things drive down turnout, they drive up the influence of organized interest groups. And I should say, you know, we're talking about teachers' unions a lot, but, you know, this happens in so many different ways. You know, school board elections can be swung by small numbers of people. So it could be someone that they don't like, the cheerleading coach or the football coach or the art teacher or something. And so a concerted group of people, because you don't need that many of them, can be like super fired up about the art teacher. They get elected to fire the art teacher and then maybe they do or maybe they don't, but then they're like, oh, there's a lot of meetings where I have budgets to approve or whatever. You know what I mean? So that's a part of the story as well, but you're right. Because what I think would happen is that if you move these elections on cycle, you are dramatically increasing the number of people who will participate in them. And therefore, all of whether it's political spending, whether it's educational campaigns, whether it's all the stuff that has to be done to win elections, you have to appeal to more people. So that makes it harder. You know, organized interest groups are always going to have an advantage in a democracy, right? It's always going to work that way because you have, when you have concentrated benefits and diffuse costs, the people getting those concentrated benefits have way stronger, you know, motivations and way more, way more reasons to be pushing for what they're pushing for. But when you have more people that they have to convince and, more opportunity for that, I think that ultimately that's a much better way of going about it.
Yeah. A few months ago, our friend Robert Ponticio put out a piece where he basically said, you know, some elite, you know, back east Dalton sort of, you know, schools have, kind of vaguely come to resemble a Khmer Rouge indoctrination camp or something. And that they didn't quickly close. Right. And he's there's sort of an applied, you know, fooey on this, like, school choice is overrating this competition argument. Now, I think that's probably true, but I also suspect that Dalton has a rather large endowment. It might be insulated from market pressures, right? do you generally, you know, like I think that the important thing to remember is that even in a well-functioning democracy, there would still be people that would be dissatisfied or wanting different things.
Yeah.
right? Like, you know, Winston Churchill said it was the best form of government except for all the, you know, the worst
yeah,
form
all
of
the, all those other ones we tried, yeah.
So as these controversies sort of like continue, I don't think we have a perfect solution for them, but where do you fall on how helpful do you think school choice would be to lowering the temperature on them?
Yeah, that's, to me, there was a great book written a few years ago that not enough people have read, John Inazu, who is a law professor. At least the last time I checked, he was a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He wrote this book called Confident Pluralism. And it's one of the things I love, because if I were to describe my views towards education and others, I consider myself to be a confident pluralist. And it's important because I take both of those words seriously. So by a pluralist, I mean that I believe in having lots of different school options for people to be able to choose from, allowing groups that are mission-oriented to create institutions that reflect their values and the things that they want out of life, and people to have the freedom to choose between them, right? And so that's sort of what I think a lot of people have talked about in the sort of traditional model of school choice, or a lot of our kind of libertarian friends that talk about turning down the volume, where it's like, well, look, the problem is, you know, these school districts, there's only one of them in, you know, in charge of an area. So it's a constant battle for who has control over it. But if you allow for, you know, different groups to organize, people can sort between them. And I think that that's true, but I also care about the first part of that sentence, which is to say, look, I'm all about pluralism, and I believe in giving people the right to have the types of schools that they want. But like, I have visions of what I think education should and shouldn't be, and I should share those visions and try and persuade people that, for example, like what they're doing at the Dalton School there is bad and wrong and they shouldn't do it. But like, I'm not going to say to those people, you know, you shouldn't have the right to have that school. If I am unable to persuade you, and our friends are unable to persuade you in what you're doing, you know, A, we might be wrong. It could be true that they are actually on a closer path to the good, the true, and the beautiful than we are. Yep. Fair enough. Like, I think having a certain amount of humility is really important. But ultimately, it could also just be that, you know, they're kind of working through their stuff and then they'll get through it eventually. So to me, my advice to people, the way that I look at it is I try to be a confident pluralist, which is I try to believe in giving people the right to have the schools the way they want them to do, but then to use the tools of persuasion and argument to try and talk about what's good and what's bad. Because I think, you know, I don't understand the solution to that. So like the Dalton School is a private school. Do we want to like outlaw what private schools can and can't teach?
Right.
That goes south pretty quickly, right?
So there are constraints to everything, right? So like, you know, market competition is not a hyper brutal Mongol horde that instantly kills anything that the public doesn't like, right? That's not how it works, especially if you happen to be highly insulated from market forces, right? So, you know, and it's generally true that you know, schooling decisions are sticky. People are reluctant to withdraw their kids once they've made friends in the school, right? So like the Austrian economics textbook, you know, like creative destruction stuff doesn't, you know, like it doesn't actually work that way in the real world.
Yeah, right? For sure.
You know, so there's limits on everything, but your study basically says there's all kinds of limits on top-down accountability as
right? There's a very important if compared to what question here, right?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Compared to what, right? Within the available set of realistic options, right? You know, which and no one's calling for getting rid of democracy. Certainly, neither you nor I would call to get rid of school district democracy per se, right? But you know, being realistic about its limitations are kind of important, right?
For sure. And thinking about, I think it's always about trying to think about who does what well and who does what poorly, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there are roles for school districts. There are roles for state education agencies, state legislatures, all of these things. There are roles for private actors. There are roles for public actors. And rather than just going along, one is good, one is bad, one is right, one is wrong, actually asking the hard questions of like, well, who's good at what? And then trying to say the people that are good at the things that they do, like that's what they should do. So like, for example, you know, we don't want to get rid of government funding of education, right? The government funds education really well. It takes a little bit of money from all of us and it puts it in a pool and then it spends it on kids. Like that's the right way to do it. We don't want to get rid of that. But then we ask the question like, well, but does government like operate schools well? It doesn't always necessarily do that. So maybe we should have some other people who wouldn't be good at funding schools, right? Because they don't necessarily have any money to do it, but they're good at operating schools. It's like, cool, let's have them operate the schools and have the government fund the schools. The government is doing what it does well. The private sector or the nonprofit sector, or even dare I say the for-profit sector, maybe there are things that they're good at. So again, rather than saying like for-profit, nonprofit, public, private, any of those, let's talk about who does what well and then try and support, have each person do the thing that they do best.
Right. And so pluralism is not, you know, it's not magic. It won't make all the problems go away. You know,
no. Right. But we're always going to argue about education, right? Like as long as we have had like recorded thoughts, it's been people arguing about how to raise kids, right? So there's no system that's going to get rid of that, nor should it. It's so important. And it's like central to like forming the next generation of humans. So like, it's good that we should argue about that. We should talk about what schools teach and how they teach it. But there are ways to limit it. And there are ways to try and channel it towards more productive ends, as opposed to what I think we see right now, which is destructive. It's zero sum. It's just like bad news bears for everybody. So channeling that into saying, oh, well, you think you've got better ideas? Why don't you run a school according to your principles? And I'll run a school according to my principles and we'll see how it goes. Like to me, that's like channeling these things to a productive end that says, put your money where your mouth is. Let's see. Maybe it turns out the kids who graduate from these schools are amazing and they're thriving in life. They're flourishing and they're wonderful citizens and great family members and others. Awesome. Like we all want to see that. So let's actually create a system that allows stuff like that to happen.